Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Trishy Mattson, and we are going to be discussing A Memory Called Empire, which is the 2020 Hugo winner from Arkady Martine. So Trish, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, it's a pleasure to have you. And if anybody thinks, wait, haven't we had this guest before? You're probably thinking of Trish's sister, Sarah, who joined me for a Comfort Reads episode about Connie Willis's book, Bellwether.
Yes.
Because you happen to be twins.
Yes. We have very similar voices. We're not identical twins, but we're a lot alike in several ways and different in others.
Yes, I believe I edited an episode that had both you and Sarah on it. And every time one of you started talking, you'd say, this is Trish,
or right.
This is Sarah.
Because otherwise, you really, it would be hard to tell.
Yes. So Trish is one of the kind of few guests, actually, on this podcast where we have sort of met prior to arranging the actual podcast. We met when working on the Supergirl podcast for The Incomparable.
That's right.
Which was one of their listener podcasts. Mm-hmm. And you are still going strong doing that with David and a couple other people, right?
Yes, it's mostly David these days. Once in a while, we get somebody else as a guest for the Supercast. But a lot of people have dropped out for one reason and another. So it's mostly David and me now.
Mm-hmm. So where else might people know you from?
Most people would know me from the world of podcasting. The first podcast I ever did anything with, and one that I'm still associated with, is the Skiffy and Fanty Show. And in fact, in 2019, when they were one of the years that they have been a finalist, I was on the list of finalists on the ballot because I had been on quite a few shows with them that year.
Nice.
And the Supergirl podcast, as you mentioned, there's also a Stargate SG Fun podcast, also associated with The Incomparable, where we take a 21st century look back at the original Stargate show. And I've been a guest on at least one other podcast, the Storium Arc podcast, which talks about the Storium website where people write round robin stories with each other in a game format.
Oh, fun.
Right. So I've been a guest on that show once. I'm also involved on Twitch, mainly in Arvin Elleron's channel, which is about sometimes watching video games and sometimes playing various role-playing games. And I'm a regular in a game we're playing through of the Dragon of Icespire Peak there. So I show up on Twitch every couple of weeks for that game. I should say, in addition to being a part of the Hugo finalist Skiffy and Fanny crew, I was also on several panels of Worldcon the last time we had a Worldcon in the virtual summer of 2020.
Oh, nice. Cool. So tell me about your nerdy history, about your history as a science fiction fantasy fan.
Certainly. Well, I grew up in a house with lots of books, and lots of them were science fiction and fantasy. Most of those were my daddy's books. My mom collected a lot of mysteries and literature, and my daddy had a lot of science fiction and fantasy and westerns and stuff, and he read mysteries too. But, I mean, as a much younger, you know, fan, I read things like The Enormous Egg and The Starlight Barking, which is the bonkers sequel to 101 Dalmatians. That is science fictional, yes.
Wow.
Things like Alexander Keyes' The Forgotten Door and Zena Henderson's The People. So, and then, you know, all the Tarzan books and most of the Mars books by Burroughs and just progressing on from there, from, you know, didn't have to leave the house to have a huge library of science fiction titles.
Right. Nice.
So, yeah, a long history in the genre.
Nice. Did you happen to tally up how many Hugo winners you'd read?
I did, and I've read 46 and part of another. There was one that I didn't finish. No, so, yeah, that's right.
Can you tell me what it is? Nobody else has to know.
I tried to read Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, and it felt like
that one's an undertaking.
It felt like a book that I should like. I rather like academics and historicals and fantasy, but I don't know. I just didn't engage with it. And after about 100 pages, sure, I started looking at something else, and I just never got back to it.
Yeah. That one is a process. So I do recommend the television adaptation. It was actually quite good.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I know that another book by that author, Susanna Clarke, I think, Piranesi, mm-hmm, is one of the Hugo finalists this year.
Yes.
And I actually have checked it out from the library and just haven't had time to start it yet.
I just bought that book because it was cheap.
Ah.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. What I've been thinking of doing is for the nominees this year, you know, I never get to read them as they come out just because I'm doing this podcast. I'm always reading other stuff, but I've started embracing audiobooks more.
Right.
And so I could get Piranesi for like $4 from the Kindle store. And then it was like $10. No, maybe it was like $7.99 to add audio or something. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, yes, definitely. Let's do that.
Right. And of course, people can always see if they can get the audiobook through Hoopla or whatever, through their, or, you know, directly from their local library.
Right. It happened that my library didn't have that one.
Mm-hmm.
So
I had, let's see, as far as A Memory Called Empire goes, I had read it from the library year that it came out. And then I bought it on sale on Kindle at some point later. And then to reread it for this podcast, since it had been 2 years or so since the book, I did a combination of reading my Kindle copy and also listening to it on Hoopla. So
okay,
so I would read a bit at night and then listen a bit more during the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did a bit of that actually for the beginning of this one. I had finished a previous book and I was getting ready to mow the lawn and I thought, oh, I should listen to an audiobook or something. And then I remembered that I had bought A Memory Called Empire on Chirp audiobooks when it was cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I listened to probably the first three chapters while I was mowing the lawn. And then I didn't get back to it for several weeks, but mm-hmm, I felt like I remember what happened in those. It turns out I didn't totally.
Mm-hmm.
So when I finally did get back and start reading it in print, I read through the whole thing and then I looped around to the beginning and reread the first couple of chapters, mm-hmm, just to make sure I remembered what had happened. Cause well, I won't get into it cause it's a little spoilery.
Sure.
But why'd you choose this book?
Well, I really, really enjoyed it. Definitely had it at the top of my ballot for the Hugo Awards. Some years I struggle a bit on which votes to weight at the top, but I didn't have any trouble this year. It was my favorite.
Nice.
I, you know, of course, I'm a big fan of science fiction. I also really like the world building in this one. I love the cultural tensions. I enjoy the poetry geeking. The characters are personable. I also really enjoy the identity, you know, the memory in your head.
Right.
You know, how that works throughout the book. And I'm interested just in language. And, you know, this book has a fair amount of that as well, although it's all tied up with culture, which, of course, language is all tied up with culture.
Right.
You know, actually, in high school, one of the careers I considered going for was linguistics. And My father discouraged me from that. He was saying marketable skills, marketable skills. Right. So in college, I was going to be a scientist, but then I ended up being a journalist, which I'm sure would also have been strongly discouraged by my father if he, you know, if he were with me, you know, when I was making that decision.
Mm-hmm. I mean, at the time, you could say it was definitely marketable.
Yeah, less so these days. It's a tough profession these days, but linguistics is pretty hot in a lot of ways. But you never know how things are going to turn out.
Well, can you kind of, as we move into the kind of non-spoiler discussion of the book, can you give a little elevator pitch for it without getting too much into spoilers?
Sure. Okay, this book has a lot of elements to it, but I guess the simplest description would be to say that the protagonist, now I can't think of her name, Dijmari, Mahit Dijmari, is an ambassador from a small polity on the borders of a very large empire who is sent as a replacement ambassador, and when she gets to the capital of where she's representing her Lazelle space station, she finds out that her predecessor was actually murdered. So she has to solve that. She's also trying to protect her station from the empire. And at this, while all this is going on, she is trying to deal with the memory of her predecessor, which is not just a memory, but the personality of the predecessor, but 15 years out of date. So she's got a lot to deal with during this book.
Yes. Yeah. And the memory is an implanted device called an imago or imago.
Right.
Yes, there's definitely a lot of moving parts to this one. And when kind of moving into overall thoughts for both of us, you mentioned that you really, really liked it. And you mentioned a couple of things, you know, when I asked, why'd you pick it? And you said the world building and the poetry. And I thought, well, that's 0-2 for me in general. In general, I've said many times I have a very low tolerance for poetry in my prose fiction. But I really enjoyed this one. And the thing that I really loved is that it's just very readable, despite things that you might think would be handicaps for it, for someone like me who doesn't really appreciate world building unless it's kind of organically done. But it wasn't just a bunch of information dumps that I found, you know, exposition-y or anything like that. It all made sense in the context of having an ambassador coming into this place that they've never actually been, even though she's, you know, Mahit is a huge fan of the Texcalan Empire.
Right.
And then when you get down to things like the poetry stuff, it's mentioned very, very often, but there isn't actually that much poetry in the book. And so I feel like I'm fine if you want to refer to how everybody is super hyper literate and memorizes poems and uses them as ciphers. Mm-hmm. As long as you don't have whole sections of the book in verse, then I'm fine.
Right. I was actually reading an interview with Arkadeep Martin on that was an NPR interview, and she said that she's not good at writing metered verse, and so she did blank verse in some places, and then as you said, just referred to it in others. But she loves the idea of, you know, that kind of thing, and also of an entire culture that is really into literature and allusions to history. So she had fun writing about it, and I had fun reading about it.
Yeah, and I did too. And I feel like there's an obvious trap that you can fall into if you're presenting this society that has this amazing poetry. Well, then you have to write amazing poetry, and not in the same language, right? So you have to write poetry if you're going to write it that rhymes. You're like, wait a second, I'm reading this in English, but it's supposed to be in the Texcalanly language? Texcalan. Right.
Texcalanly.
Yeah, sorry, I'm going to mess that up a few times.
The Texcalanly Empire, yes.
Yes. And the people are the Texcalanlitlim.
Litlim, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so that can be something you could get into some trouble with.
I'll just mention, as far as the pronunciations and Tlaxcalanlitzim language and everything, this people who struggle with languages shouldn't be intimidated to pick up this book. Oh, I'm going to have to, you know, skip over every fourth word or something like that. No, there are a lot more references to the language than there are actual made up foreign words in the book. And it is probably far more about cultural translation than than struggling with language issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and definitely, you know, for somebody who also enjoys linguistics, just kind of hobbyist, at a hobbyist level, the differences between languages and what that implies in cultures and how that's all worked out, there is a lot of that where Mahit will be wondering, oh, well, okay, what flexibility is there in this word, or is there a more specific word that I need to be using for this?
Right, and I was also, you know, struck by a passage where there is a thing that the Tlaxcalanli do that she considers barbaric, but she can't actually say so in Tlaxcalanli language because of how self-centric it is. It would be like saying this act that a citizen is doing is uncitizen-like, know, and couldn't really get any farther, any closer to it than that because of the structure and attitudes of the language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By definition, anything they do is civilized.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mentioned that it was a pleasure to read just because, you know, I had come off reading Stand on Zanzibar, which is a good book, but it is not easy to read.
Oh, no.
And I think before that it was Rainbow's End, and that one also was no picnic. So I was delighted. And, you know, it's a 400-page book, and some of those can be a slog. But yeah, this one, it was a nice one to read on a plane. I read about half of it on the way to Omaha and back.
Right. It juggles a lot, but it is not at all difficult to engage with.
Yeah. It's interesting that there is quite a bit of world building. I feel like the world here is quite broad, quite big, but there's not a ton of description about stuff. And I thought that was fascinating. You know, like the throne room is described, right?
Right.
And you get a little description of LaSalle Station as well, mostly toward the end of the book.
Yeah, mostly the differences are described through references to things that Mahit misses, like she's weirded out by having the sky above her,
right?
You know, it's like something that's always in the back of her mind that she has to keep track of. And you know, when she first comes to the city or the jewel of the city, she wonders if the dust motes that she sees floating in the air, if those might be one of the problems with her malfunctioning memory implant, her imago.
Right.
Because the station is super filtered air and she just hasn't seen free floating dust before. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are little details sprinkled through like that, but there are hardly any physical descriptions in the book. You learn pretty quickly that Mahit is tall. But other than that, it's several chapters before you get to, like, what hair color she has or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, it's also the book is written by a woman, and so you don't get these exhaustive descriptions of everyone's bodies.
Oh, goodness, no.
Like you get in the 50s male gaze sci-fi writers.
Right, right.
Yeah, you mentioned the sky, and the few times that was mentioned, I kind of had to remind myself that this was all planet side and not just in kind of sealed up environments. Like I pictured it sort of like the 1980s Brave New World adaptation that was on TV, where everything just looked like old Star Trek sets.
Right. Corridors and more corridors.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I think maybe that's just my default picture in science fiction. The character development here is not super, super rich, but I feel like you get to know people enough to decide if you like them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just adored Three Seagrass. I thought she was tremendous.
Yes, and 12 Azalea is a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, yeah, and their relationship is great.
Mm-hmm. And I think you get a pretty sharp picture of 19 Ads, too.
Yes, definitely.
Who is, let's see, how to describe her. She is an influential political figure who is...
Yeah, extremely competent.
Right, extremely competent. And intimidating. she is sort of a... Well, I wouldn't exactly call her an ally of Maat Zamare because she's more someone who offers refuge while intending to make use of Maat. Right.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, she's in a very safe jail for a while.
Yes.
I'm trying to think what else we should talk about in kind of non-spoilers before we dive into more in the spoiler talk. I do want to talk about comps, you know, any similar titles, you know, similar books, similar movies, any other properties that you can think
of? Yeah, I did think of several, actually. Okay, so as far as having more than one personality involving the same body, the immediate mm-hmm. analogy that I thought of was Deep Space Nine with the Trill.
Yes, me too.
Right, where so you have these slug-like creatures that are implanted in people mm-hmm. In a symbiotic relationship, and mm-hmm. The Trill themselves have much longer lives than the humanoids who are their hosts, and so you'll have like Jadzia Dax and then Ezri Dax, and they mm-hmm. have the memories of their former hosts, but usually they are just memories that can be tapped, although sometimes there are problems and those personalities can try to take over.
Yeah, and there's some personality in there too, probably a little more than with the Imagos here.
Right. For a more recent example, I was thinking of Yoon-Ha Lee's Nine Fox Gambit and following books. That was a 2016 debut novel, I think, but certainly the first in that series. And in that case, there is someone who's deemed I think it was a war criminal of that culture, or at least a traitor. But they mm-hmm. They were a very good strategist and useful memories. And so that person's memories were implanted in another person, a young and fairly inexperienced, relatively inexperienced soldier. That's a really, really good book. And that actually, I voted for the Hugo Award for that year. If you're more interested in issues of cultural imperialism, I would highly recommend Robert Jackson Bennett's 2014 book, City of Stairs, where there was a planetary empire, and this is a fantasy book, the way that fell was that essentially another nation that had been colonized managed to destroy the gods of the empire. Then the book is another murder mystery where somebody is trying to find out what happened to a predecessor. It's fantasy, and there's a lot of stuff about this is someone from the successful rebel nation who comes to visit the old empire. So there are similarities there, but there are also many great differences. There's no personality implant or anything like that in that one. Let's see what else. As far as translation issue goes, of course, Arrival, or if you want a series, C.J. Cherry's Foreigner series.
Okay. Nice. I wrote down The Expanse and actually C.J. Cherry's Alliance Union series, just kind of because of the stuff in this book about kind of the stationers versus the planet people.
Yeah.
There isn't so much of a rivalry there, but there is the barbarian thing, right? Where Mahit always knows that she's a barbarian. She always knows that she's not a citizen and can't really be one.
Right.
So, yeah. Okay. I think it's time to get in spoilers. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. Sounds good to me.
Okay. Yeah. So from here on forward, it's just freeform discussion. Anything that you want to talk about is fair game, and assume people are okay with spoilers or they have turned off the podcast.
Right. There's so much that is fun and interesting about this book. But let me just start with one bit of world building that niggled at me a little bit. I never really figured out where humanity started here, because I mean it feels like it should have been started with Texcalon, because everything is so centric and, you know, they have the thousands of year history and everything like that. But you have these stations that seemed like they've always been independent, which certainly wouldn't have been allowed if Texcalon were the founding creator of space travel. So it seems like they must all have come from somewhere else, but you don't get that sense at all. Texcalon feels permanent and eternal.
Mm-hmm. I think that's intentional from the culture.
Right. I mean, they could have just erased those parts of history that they didn't want to think about, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it kind of reminds me of in the Foundation series, there's some talk of, is Earth real? Do we know if Earth is real? Mm-hmm. where there's that whole attempt to look back into history and find out where Earth is.
Okay. All right. Let's see. So digging into the plot a little bit, we find out about the Imogo thing not quite after things have already gone dreadfully wrong, but they're still not going great, because for Mahit, she only got her Imogo implant 3 months ago. And usually in our culture, they take a year for integration of the memories with the new host. And so she's still trying to work things out with her new old person.
Predecessor.
Who is the, at that point when he was made, I've been living with this person again for a month and I can't think of his name.
Iskander?
Yeah, Iskander. Thank you. Sorry. I don't know why I'm having trouble. Iskander Agaban. So she finds out that, you know, they needed a new ambassador here because the predecessor is dead. And when she views the body of the former ambassador, his implant of 15 years ago in her head
goes on tilt.
Basically shorts out. She, through a lot of the book, is hoping that he'll come back and advise her. And meanwhile, having odd physical effects like fizzy nerves along her arms and legs. And so she's trying to deal with that. And also, I mean, it certainly seems suspicious that he would die of a food allergy at a banquet. But, you know, she's not quite sure that he's been murdered, but she definitely finds out that he's been heavily involved in politics, which you would kind of have to be as an ambassador trying to find any leverage you could to stop the Mammoth Empire from gobbling up your space stations.
Right. Yeah. And it's kind of the perfect setup, right? Where you establish that there's this almost advantage she has with the Imago machine. And you can see how useful it would be at the beginning of the book when he's kind of filling in some blanks for her. But then, it goes on the fritz and she's in the same situation we are, not really knowing what's going on. And it's interesting that the people that she meets with have particular expectations of her actually being Iskander.
Right.
Because they don't understand the technology. They don't understand the personality integration or anything like that. And it's a really interesting science fiction concept where does Mahit end and Iskander start?
Yes.
Are they something different than they were at the beginning? Kind of goes back to the Trill thing, right? Is this a unique combination, or is the Trill host subsumed by the symbiote.
Right. It's also interesting. This technology is supposed to be a deep secret that they right. have kept from the Texcalanlis because it's mm-hmm. somewhat of a tactical advantage to have this knowledge.
Yes.
As she goes along, she finds out that a lot of people know something about this, and that is because mm-hmm. Iskander was trying to leverage this technology to buy protection, essentially, for his home.
Mm-hmm.
So, she Might is struggling then, with, do I confirm? Do I play dumb? There's a beautiful scene where she goes to a party and is pretending to be the dumb barbarian because, even less knowledge than she does have, so that hopefully people will reveal things to her or while she's around, mm-hmm. thinking that she is essentially harmless.
Mm-hmm. This is way deep in spoilers, obviously. Do you think, did Iskander really tell the Emperor what the Imago machines did? Because it seems like if the information that we're given in the book is when you have, a fully formed personality who takes on an Imago machine, that there's a blending of the personalities, sort of. But really, it doesn't just crush the host. Whereas they're talking about implanting the old Emperor's Imago in his 90% clone, who's only, 10 years old? And the idea is there, it would just take over the personality. It would overwrite the master boot record of the 90% clone. And that's kind of horrifying.
Yes, it is horrifying. it's basically a plan to murder a clone's mind and just use that body.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of Get Out a little bit, actually, now I'm thinking of it that way.
Right, right. Or Ancillary Justice with what happened
yes.
to the ancillaries. When I read that book mm-hmm. and realized that these weren't just, clone trooper. Well, I don't want to spoil Ancillary Justice for people
who right. just haven't,
but there's an analogous situation, shall we say.
Yes. Yeah.
So right. It's a horrifying thought that they're planning to do this, that the Emperor was planning to do this because he believes that he's the only one who can keep the empire on an even keel and,
right.
internal peace and everything. And as we find out toward the end of the book, that's not actually, he was, how much of it was him genuinely believing that nobody else could do it and how much was him just wanting to believe that so that he'd have a good excuse to mm-hmm. keep hanging on.
And I think that's where I questioned, did Iskander tell him that he would have continuity of consciousness across, from the Imago thing? And Black Mirror has played with this quite a few times
mm-hmm.
Where they have people, put something in their brain that kind of maps their personality and then you take that out and put it in something else.
Oh, right. This is not a new concept.
No, definitely not.
Back to... we can remember it for you, Wholesale and various other,
right.
The Citeen yeah. stories where you learn through a combination of tapes and RNA
yes.
stuff. It's not all science fictional. We've discovered that epigenetic memories, or not memories, but epigenetics can carry something that happens to a previous generation to even skip a generation. Like if you undergo a famine, your grandchild will have a tendency to retain and gain weight because somewhere in your epigenetics, they know, it's danger of famine. So you better hold on to that nutrition.
Is that what happened to me?
Well, I'm sure a lot of us would like to blame our current habit, on.
Yeah.
But, right. Not a new concept in science fiction, but I really love how Arkady explores it in this book.
Yeah, you can even go over to the kind of fantasy side and the new agey side of the past lives and that kind of stuff.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for me, you know, the interesting thing to think about is that continuity of consciousness idea, where if the imago probably thinks that it has continuity of consciousness, you know, to the extent that it can think, mm-hmm. right? There's no way that you can interrogate it to find out if it is the original personality, because it's always going to think that no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Back to your question that I never really answered, though, as to what Iskander had told the emperor. I think it's entirely possible that he told him enough to get him intrigued on the idea and let him make assumptions and fill in the blanks. There are things that Mahit tells the emperor that he had not heard before. So obviously Iskander didn't tell him everything about the technology. He probably held out information as bait and to...
Yes.
But, you know, at the point that he was trying to sell it to the emperor, Iskander, or to sell the secret to buy safety for his people, he didn't have an imago machine with him. So, you know, even right. at that point, he would have had to somehow get his hands on another machine, which presumably he would have had to go through the Minister of Mining on the station. But then, so, right. so anyway, I think he was still in the initial negotiations with the emperor when he got murdered, because certain people didn't like the idea of that kind of change from, you know, a new emperor every generation or so to an eternal, you know, god emperor or whatever you would call it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you can see how it could be kind of easily done under the table, and Iskander's path to getting this approved by the station. It's like, hey, only the emperor is going to really know about this.
Right.
And, you know, he appoints his successor, and his successor thinks that he's the previous guy. And down the line, the emperor believes he's immortal, but really isn't.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so one other issue I wanted to talk about was the importance of social media to this plot.
Yes.
At one point, Mahit and her two allies, which are her liaison officer, Three Seagrass, and Three Seagrass's friend, 12 Zalia, who just got roped into this fairly haplessly, they are being held in a place while revolution attempts are underway. And they wanted to reach the emperor, but have been stymied and basically locked up in a conference room. And the way that they move out of this situation is that they write, Three Seagrass and Mahit Dismare write a poem together and release it on the social media nets. And that gets repeated throughout the nets until it comes to the attention of 19 ads, who send someone to get them out of it. And I think the idea is even more credible now, more understandable and believable now than it was when this book came out a couple of years ago. Just as we've seen the prominence of social media in protests in America and abroad. And, you know, maybe in our culture, these things wouldn't take the form of a poem with allusions to previous poems and literature and history. You know, in whatever way a creation can grab the attention of people and then get reproduced and then played with, like on TikTok, where you take the original and then, you know, make your own reaction to it in the shot and so on. So I loved the idea of that, you know, the cleverness of it, and then how you see a line from that poem get repeated over and over and becoming part of a very crucial part of the culture of the Tezcalanli. It just, you know, it was unexpected to me, but then looking at, you know, what the book had had, it seemed absolutely an organic evolution of some of the earlier parts of the book. So I loved how that developed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it, you know, it does definitely present that the Tezcalanli people are very plugged in, right, with the cloud hook, which I still can't quite picture. I think I kind of picture it like what is the name of the pilot on Star Trek Discovery?
Geordi on his visor? Or Discovery. I don't know Discovery, their name.
Yeah, I can't remember. But she has the artificial eye, and she's got like a little thing over her eyebrow. Or even like Seven of Nine.
I was actually thinking of, you know, way back to Google Glasses, and, you know, that did not succeed, but I'm sure there will be. Elliot de Baudard has some very interesting stories with, what are they called? Impressions, something like that, where you see the world through a filter. And, you know, numerous other people, of course, have written other similar stories like that. But, so I didn't actually have much trouble. I didn't try too hard to picture it physically, but it's something that, you know, you just wear on your head and is easily detachable. So it's not, it is definitely not an implant. It's just, you know, a thing that you wear pretty naturally.
Yeah. That evidently when the data is going, it kind of blanks out one of your eyes, which I thought was interesting.
Right. Or, you know, I think of it maybe like a heads up display that just you carry around with you everywhere.
Yeah. By the way, Detmer was the character I was thinking on Star Trek Discovery. Yeah. There are definitely a couple of hints of things that I'm curious if they're picked up in future books, and you don't have to go into spoilers, but I think you've already read the next book.
I have read the next book, A Desolation Called Peace.
Okay. Do we get any further development of the Sunlit and what they are?
The sequel is a more outward-focused book.
Okay.
No, essentially. Not in this one.
Okay. The impression I get is that the Sunlit and the city AI are somehow connected. And that reminded me a little bit of Ancillary Justice, where you have, you know, the ship or the station that has its own AI that controls lots of different things. And so I was kind of seeing the Sunlit as potentially androids or ancillaries of some kind, or people with a hive mind, or like the Bynars on Star Trek The Next Generation. So it's just kind of a little enticing little tidbit that she doesn't really pull on too far.
Right. I am sure that they are not androids. They are people.
Okay.
I think maybe I read a short story somewhere, maybe, where that is explained a little more. I think they can go off duty from being Sunlit people. So they would hook into the hive mind and back out again. I could be conflating this with something else, but that is my impression.
Okay. One thing I thought was not fun, but like something that I identified with, was how tired Mihit gets, because she goes through at least two assassination attempts. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, how do you find time to take a nap when that's happening? And I think it's amusing that essentially they just go out into like a park and lay down on the grass and sleep.
Right. That's one of the obvious advantages of this empire, is that this totally, you know, panopticon, eyes everywhere, cameras everywhere, civilization, is that you can just go to a park and feel safe and comfortable lying down on the grass and sleeping there.
Yeah. You're not going to get disappeared.
Right.
Because everybody would see.
Right. And you're not going to get mugged either.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that reminded me of times where I've been really, really tired. I was going to ask you, I meant to send you beforehand. Do you remember the most tired you've ever been?
During the aftermath of Hurricane Florence, which hit Wilmington pretty much dead on, I worked for 17 days straight, because I'm a journalist. That was tiring. Let's see. Yeah, there was, I remember one day about 20 years ago when I was working for the Phoenix in Phoenixville, that I worked for about 24 hours, went home, slept for an hour, went back to work, and worked for another 10 hours. That was probably the most tired I've ever been.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely had a couple of projects that I worked on in college as an engineering major that where I was up for 40 hours. Mm-hmm. And then I remember one of them after we all finished this project and my wife and I got married really young. And so we had everybody from my engineering lab over to our apartment for a kind of a party afterwards. And I fell asleep in the middle of the room with a bunch of people there. So, and then just a couple of years ago, we flew to Israel for our son was in the open water junior world championships there. Mm-hmm. And we flew to London and we had purposely gotten a really long layover, 9-hour layover in London, because neither of us had ever been to England. And so we flew into London. So we're exhausted from the transatlantic flight.
Yes.
And then, you know, we land there at 11 o'clock in the morning and left the airport and went and walked around London for a few hours and then back to the airport, found a place to take a shower, then back on another plane and all the way over to Israel. And then a 5-hour bus ride to our final destination.
Oh my gosh.
And, and yeah, it was really something, but it was worth it. It was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. When you get really exhausted, I thought some of the symptoms were described pretty well. There is for me, other than just the overwhelming tiredness, there's your ears are kind of hypersensitive and yet muffled at the same time.
Yes. Everything has a halo around it too.
Yes. Right. And just the heaviness, your whole body feels heavy and, you know, coffee only helps up to a certain point. And after that, it's just endurance and, willpower. Yeah. So, I certainly thought the, descriptions of exhaustion seemed on point in this book and evocative.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting that they kind of had back alley neurosurgery.
Yeah.
It reminded me of the eye transplant scene from Minority Report.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Where you're just in a random kind of sketchy looking place and somebody's going to replace your eyes for you.
Yeah. I mean, terrifying to put yourself in the hands of, you know, a third person contact that you know nothing about, that, you know, a friend of a friend of yours or a friend of an associate of yours has a friend of a friend who says they can do neurosurgery. So, but she was absolutely desperate. The circumstances were extreme enough where she had a coded message from her government that she could not decipher without her Imago's help. And so basically she told the surgeon, you know, as long as I live and I have my mental faculties, that's all that's important. So implying that, you know, paralysis or whatever other effects would be tolerable as long as she can still think after the procedure. So, Yeah.
I mean, I really like Mahit just because of the fact that she got to that situation where she's like, I don't have another option here. This is what I have to go with. And so I'm making that decision. And it's it might be sketchy, it might be a terrible mistake, but it's the one decision left to me.
Yeah, I like how you get taken through her ethical choices that she's making. So you can understand why she's doing what she's doing. And there's enough explained about her background that you understand why these choices are difficult for her. Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting, you know, the cultural taboos where things that are totally natural to her are horrific to the Txikalanli, and vice versa. So, which, you know, is absolutely true of cultures that exist in the world. So it was just, but it was fun to see things that came out. Like she had trouble making herself eat something that was actually from a real animal that had been alive and was now dead in her sandwich or whatever it was. You know, which certainly a lot of people today would refuse to do. in our culture, in our world. One thing that strikes me is I really liked that they had the scenes with the rebels and the underculture of the, illegal scientists and stuff, because for a lot of the book, the Tex Kalanli seem like a monolith, and that's the way they present themselves. And how, certainly the ones in power and a lot of the people, a lot of the characters want their culture to be monolithic. But you see that there are cracks in the culture and people who are not satisfied with the way that things are. I'm just glad that part of the book, aside from the funness of the plot, it also adds more realism that, there are some people who are not really down with the way that things play out in this culture.
Yeah. I mean, and that makes it a little more realistic, right? We only have one planet and we can't all get along.
Right.
So an empire, and even the fact that the city is basically one planet. That was hard to keep track of in my head, was that how far did they go for that neurosurgery? I have no idea, really.
Several hours, but we don't know what kind of propulsion system was being used in their transport. So could have been, 30 miles, or it could have been 900 miles. Who knows?
Yeah. And, back to the kind of the prescription in Tex Kalanli culture against technologies and implants and that kind of stuff. It makes so much sense on a station to have something like an Imago, especially when you're talking about like pilots.
Right. Right.
And the ability to pass on maps of solar systems and asteroid belts and that kind of stuff. It reminds me of, if you've ever read anything about, exploration, the days of naval exploration, on ships, when we didn't have maps of some oceans, well, you might be able to buy, it's called a rudder, which was like a detailed log from another pilot captain of a ship, who would tell you, here's how I got from Portugal to Japan. And it was hot technology. There was espionage that went on at that time, and it was, you could get yourself executed for, appropriating one of those.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Certainly the Portuguese kept their trade routes very secret. And I'm sure a lot of other cultures did too. That's just one that, sticks in my mind.
But aboard the station, the whole idea of reusing things, you're literally reusing people's knowledge.
Right. Right.
In a way that's different than just writing it down.
Right. Well, I think I read somewhere that the original population of the station, which was originally a generation ship, was they only had like 30,000 people or so every person, every skill set was precious, and I have little idea of how technically feasible recording a memory in electronics, transferring it from person to person would be, but there would absolutely be a huge incentive to develop that kind of technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Which you do not need as much in a sprawling, centralized, bureaucratized, empire like the Tex Kalanli.
Right. Right. Especially when they have their other ways of maintaining memories, like through their poetry and through their other cultural things.
Yes.
Well, we've been going a while. We can keep going if you've got other stuff you want to talk about.
To just spoil the ending.
There we go.
I really loved how, various allusions to sacrifices are made throughout the book. I wasn't expecting what happened at the end of the book, but it felt absolutely right and, clever thing of the Emperor to do. He couldn't secure...
And it had been set up really well.
He couldn't continue himself, but he stopped the multifaceted rebellion and secured the succession of his choice, even if not of his own person. But, you know, he managed to put in fairly incontestable power his close associate who had been important, but not one of his formal heirs before.
Right.
And having that person be a sort of guardian for his 90% clone, who would eventually presumably succeed 19 adds, who becomes the emperor after the broadcast suicide sacrifice of the emperor. So it was just an amazing scene. And, you know, when I was reading it the first time racing along, I didn't see what was going to happen until it did happen.
Right.
But it was like, oh, yeah, wow. You know, it just absolutely worked.
I was reading that part on a plane, and on planes I don't tend to read super, super fast because I get distracted. But I started getting up to that part, and I had earlier when Mahit was originally with 19 ads, I thought, I wonder if she's going to become really important later. And so I wasn't super, super surprised at her being kind of named as the regent.
No, I loved the moment where Mahit and Three Seagrass are watching the broadcast, and they see 19 as listening to what the emperor is saying, and she all of a sudden looks horrified and simultaneously resigned. And I think I had an inkling then of what might happen, but it was only a few paragraphs later that it did happen. So I can't claim any great credit for figuring that out.
When she started having that reaction, and so did Three Seagrass, I thought, oh, okay, I think I know what's going to happen here. Because it had been set up well in the book, the idea of that blood sacrifice.
Right. And of course, blood sacrifice was an element. So the text Kalanli, in interviews that I've read or listened to with Arkady McMartin, they're an amalgamation of several elements, but those would include Aztecs and Byzantines and the American imperialism aspects. And so, you know, the blood sacrifice certainly goes along with the Aztec culture, although not so much self-sacrifice that I'm aware of, but I'm not well-versed in Aztec culture, so.
I found the ending quite satisfying, and I may continue the series, but the sequel did not win, and so it might be a while till it did.
Right.
Although I only have 20 left to actually read. I've got more episodes than that, but cool. Final thoughts.
I think this is a great book. Well, depending on how you define great, it is a very enjoyable, interesting book that I would recommend to just about anybody, really. There are so many things in it that are interesting. And I know that Arkady Martin is working on books outside this series, and I'm very interested to see what she does setting up other worlds and people. I'm, you know, just think a minute. This was her debut novel. That's just an amazing feat. So I'm hoping for many more years of novels and hopefully more Hugo winners from this author.
Yes, agreed. Yeah, I would agree that this one is very enjoyable. In terms of the overall, you know, the kind of objective literary quality, I don't know. I'm not sure I'm smart enough to opine on that, but I really enjoyed it.
Yes.
And definitely recommend it. Cool. All right. Well, Trish, before we sign off, where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter at P.E. Matson, P-E-M-A-T-S-O-N. And I blog, you know, you can see links to my other podcasts and Twitch activities and some poetry I've written and things on www.whatsthewordnow.blogspot.com.
Nice. And I admire your Twitter, not your Twitter handle, but your Twitter name, which says Patrifid.
Yes.
Because I love the Day of the Triffids.
Yep.
Well, Trish, it was great to talk to you again.
It was a really enjoyable discussion. Thank you.
It was. Awesome. All right. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Trish. I had a great time talking to her, and I will put all her contact info in the show notes. And as I mentioned on the podcast, I only have maybe 20 of these left. So if you've been procrastinating, thinking, I'll eventually volunteer for an episode, you might want to get your foot in the door now. I can pencil you in for an episode, even if we don't get to you for a year. But if you want to do that, you can shoot me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or fill out the contact form on the website. As always, if you would like to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/hugospodcast if you want to support financially. But if you want to support in a non-monetary fashion, you can retweet the episodes, share them with your friends, leave a review wherever you listen to the podcast. I'd really appreciate that. Of course, if you're not following me on social media, well, honestly, you're not missing that much, but @hugospodcast on Twitter if you want to follow me. And also, as always, this podcast was recorded with Zencastr, so definitely check out zencastr.com if you are an aspiring podcaster and you need a tool to help you record over the internet, because that's the way I do most of mine. Although, we are back to recording in person for Take Me to Your Reader, which is awesome, because we're all vaccinated. Okay, I think that'll about wrap it up for this time, so I'll talk to you next time. Thank you for listening. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.